Hi, Eric.
Hi, Aaron.
Hey, so how about a taboo subject?
Oh, okay. Well, that's great, because
today we're going to...
That's our trend.
We're gonna grab the third rail some more.
Okay. The fourth rail.
Is it the fourth rail?
I don't know.
Okay. I learned about the third rail while watching West Wing. Did you ever watch West Wing?
No, I never did.
So much good.
Yeah, I it sounds like something I would like, but
it's really,
I have a hard time committing to TV.
It's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it's really fun to watch. And at kind of near the end of the main guy's presidency, they decide they're going to do some Social Security stuff.
Okay.
And it's the third rail.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't grab.
No, don't grab the third rail.
Because you'll
electricity
be electrocuted.
Yeah. I'm from a freight train town, but even I know that.
Well, I want to ask the direct question today.
Okay, direct question. Let me close my eyes so I can brace myself.
Okay, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Why do women not hold the priesthood?
Are you going to tell me? Are you going to give me an answer?
Is that where you expected I'd just start today?
No, but as soon as you said it, I wasn't surprised.
Okay.
Yeah.
We had a conversation last week, last time about it. And I don't think we have, there's this implied question in the church, right? It's always there, right? Whenever we talk about women in the church and when we talk about the past and the present and the future, there's always this underlying implied question, right? That is usually unstated in public, right? But discussed in classrooms on occasion or, you know, around family home evening. And it's that question. Why are women not... Let me actually restate it a bit.
Okay.
Why are women not ordained to the priesthood and serve in leadership roles?
I have no good answer.
We could just answer and say we don't know and then call it a show.
Yes, that's...
Here's a quote from Gordon B. Hinckley.
Okay.
All right. This quote is on Reddit. So,
that's a good source.
I haven't checked to see if it's been transcribed properly.
Face and Hat, where you come for...
No, Face and Hat has a stronger... There's a link here. I'm going to open the link. We're gonna follow through. This is called Men and Women and Priesthood Power. It is a talk by Elder Russell M. Ballard.
President Hinckley at all.
Given in September 14.
Maybe he's quoting President Hinckley in the talk.
Let's find out. Again, we have a responsibility.
We're modeling doing proper research live.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Why are men and not women ordained to priesthood offices? President Gordon B. Hinckley explained that it was the Lord, not man, who designated men in his church should hold the priesthood, and who endowed women with capabilities to round out this great and marvelous organization, which is the church and the kingdom of God. Then, that's the end of President Hinckley's quote.
Yeah.
And Elder Ballard said, "The Lord has not revealed why he has organized his church as he has." Let's stop for a minute.
Okay.
And not make a value statement, okay? Let's make value statements later.
Okay.
And let's start with definitions.
Definitions. All right.
All right.
Take it away.
Let's do some definitions. Let's do some history. Let's get some talk context. Okay? And I have to say, I want to say why I wanted to do a show on this topic.
Okay.
Right? It's because this topic about women in the church drives me. It makes me want to talk. It makes me want to read. It makes me want to think, right? Mm-hmm. It makes me want to look at history. It makes me want to look at religion. It makes me want to look deeper into the scriptures. And it makes me want to explore. So that's why I wanted to do another show on it, right? And however many shows we did on it, it wouldn't really be enough, right? And again, I have a education in a different subject. What authority do I have to talk about this? What authority do you have to talk about this?
Well, Aaron,
yeah.
we are saints.
We are saints. Yeah. This is true.
Yeah, we are baptized. We are given the Holy Ghost. It is our responsibility to seek out. Joseph Smith would be disappointed in us if we didn't ask questions and push for answers.
So, I just wanted to say, this is why I want to continue down this particular topic. There is some great things to talk about when we talk about the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
When we abstract away the concept of priesthood, from the discussion about women and the church, right? The priesthood itself is it's great. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what it means. And the reason I want to do this is because I know that we have members of the church listening to our show that come from all walks of life.
Yeah.
That have different levels of educations and different beliefs. We have non-members that listen to our show. We have young members that listen to our show. Let's go ahead and be specific.
Yeah.
Eric.
Okay.
Professor Eric.
I do profess a lot. So.
What's the priesthood?
The priesthood is the authority to act in God's name.
That's a very nice answer.
Thank you.
What does it mean?
It means that in some way more than just by virtue of doing good in the world, a person with the priesthood has authority to do specific kinds of good. I would say that the difference between a good person being doing God's work, doing the work of Jesus in this world, like, you know, taking care of the poor, like, I think the difference that the priesthood provides is the opportunity to do things like perform ordinances. Shy of performing ordinances, just about anything. So I'm Elders Quorum President right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the things that I have done as Elders Quorum President that were, that I did because I was the Elders Quorum President, because of my position in the church. Almost all that stuff did not actually require the priesthood.
Be specific.
Helping, someone find housing, helping, someone, in a dangerous situation, escape their housing, helping people have enough food to eat, helping, people, and you know, just a lot of temporal stuff, right? These are things that good people can do for each other, and it doesn't really require the priesthood. But because of my position, and as the sustained Elders Quorum President of the Berkeley Ward, these opportunities were put in my way to help people that otherwise I may not have, you know, no needed help or been in the right position to help them. So
what did the priesthood do for you?
What did the priesthood do for me in terms of me helping people with their temporal issues?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. One easy answer would be to say nothing in particular,
yeah.
Right? Like you know, to help someone in a move, anybody can help with that, right? Like, you could invite your friend who is not a member of the church to help someone move, and they would do just as good a job of lifting boxes and wrangling a piano as someone who does have the priesthood. So in a very literal sense, with most of these activities, the priesthood maybe isn't particularly important.
So where is it important?
Well, like I said, ordinances. You need the priesthood to baptize someone, for instance.
What's an ordinance?
An ordinance is some sort of physical activity, yeah, which carries spiritual importance.
Yeah. Remember, I've mentioned this before. There's a definition.
Yeah. I remember. I don't remember which episode it was.
Yeah.
If you can tell me, I will. That'd be great.
An ordinance is a ceremony.
I like the word ceremony.
Yeah, ceremony is important because ceremonies are meaningless. And let me explain, yeah, what I mean by that, right? What I mean is that when I take a nail and I hammer it into a wall, that nail stays there, right? Sure. That's a physical act.
Yeah.
But when I put my hands on someone's head and say words,
yes,
right? There's no physical measurement I can make that in that the universe has changed, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
So it's a ceremony. But yes, it has a physical meaning and, mm-hmm, a spiritual effect.
Yes.
So those are the two parts of the definition that it goes with it.
Can I read you a sentence?
Yeah.
This is from an article we will identify by name later.
Okay.
But the sentence goes like this. Religious historians have long regarded ritual. I know.
Ceremony and ritual.
Yeah, these are all related ideas. Have long, of course, ritual also includes things like, the talks in sacrament meeting, which are not ordinances, but they are part of the ritual. Anyway, so religious historians have long regarded ritual as a lens through which they can examine, I cannot read the next word, I'll explain more why later, something communities, in which they can explain, through which they can examine how communities created and recreated their cultural world. So I think that's another, and I think that's an important point too. Like the rituals we have, including ordinances, help us define what makes us us as a religious community as opposed to some other religious community.
I think ritual and ordinance and ceremony is an important part of the church.
Sure.
It helps us be centered. It helps us know what we're doing, right? But then also we ascribe celestial importance to them.
Yes.
What are the five ordinances required for salvation?
Baptism, confirmation, little squeakily, ordination to the priesthood.
Yep. I'm being a stinker by using this number.
Yeah. And then the endowment and sealings.
Yeah. For the highest degree of the celestial kingdom.
Yeah. Tippity top.
Yep. So that number five, we're going to come back to it later in the show. But those are called saving ordinances,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, but it's not just ordinances that the priesthood is about.
No, but I think I'm going to stick with my argument. I have a feeling you have something interesting planned, but I'm going to stick with my argument for right now that's the primary purpose. Things that cannot be done without the priesthood are ordinances, and they're important.
Okay, I'd agree with you on that point, right? Okay, so why, there's a certain leadership aspect to priesthood, is there not?
Yes. Okay. In fact, that's really the only definition in the Old Testament.
Go on.
Right? I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, wise listenership, but priesthood in the Old Testament is just the priests and the things that only the priests can do. And the priesthood is the people who do these things that only they can do and...
Well, so outside of the church, you refer it to joining the priesthood.
Sure, yeah. And I remember having, I don't remember who it was or what ward it was, but somebody was complaining how the bishop or whoever was conducting sacrament meeting would thank the priesthood for taking care of the sacrament. And said, that's not the priesthood. The priesthood isn't people. The priesthood is this authority.
Yeah.
But in most Christian tradition and in Judaic tradition, I think it's fair to say that priesthood is the people. I think that's true. I mean, I'm not an expert in the vocabulary and the quirks of vocabulary in all Judeo-Christian traditions, but I think I'm being accurate when I say that. But of course, people use the words differently. I just shared a tweet with some of my Mormon literature friends from a Christian who was talking about the role of literature in the church, and it confused a couple of them because they didn't realize that she was an LDS. And when she says the church, like, it has a very different meaning than when Latter-day Saints talk about the church.
Go on.
When we say the church, we mean the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We mean the leadership in Salt Lake City. We mean all the wards and branches and in the stakes of Zion scattered across the world. We mean a very specific religious tradition. But in a lot of Christianity, when you say the church, you just mean sort of this concept that of the Christian body. Like, I don't know that I fully understand what they mean by the church, but the church is just like Christians generally and everybody who attends a religious tradition. And it sort of includes churches generally. At least that's how she was using it. I don't know if, say, a Catholic, I suspect a Catholic would use the word a bit more like we do. Mm-hmm. And I think this terminology is probably more Protestant, but I don't know. I'm not an expert.
Hmm. This meaning of priesthood, this meaning of church and everything.
Yeah.
When I said before that priesthood and leadership are often joined.
Yeah.
Right? In our church, that isn't necessarily how can I describe this? It's not though, but it is, but it's not, but it is.
Until the Relief Society was formed, you had to have the priesthood have any sort of calling in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's accurate.
Listen, one of the things that we're going to do in this show today is talk about how women have changed throughout history.
Yeah.
Right?
The primitive church, we'll hit the early Latter-day Saint tradition.
Mm-hmm.
We're delving into the... We're Bill and Ted in this thing.
Right. Exactly. And one of the things that I found when I was looking into this is exactly as you say, but even the point of like praying in church and things that we would take for granted normally, mm-hmm. right? You know, were denied to women. Yeah. Not so very long before, long ago, in our own tradition. In fact, let me read you this little bit here. This is from Mormonism and Women, which is a Wikipedia article. Okay. And what it says is...
By the way, can I just add props to everybody who works on Wikipedia articles related to the church? I want to shout out one person specifically, my friend Rachel Helps, who used to live near us in our county. Now she works for BYU. Her name is Rachel Helps, and she runs a student team who just spend their time making these articles better. So props to her and her team and everybody else who's just doing it freelance and making Wikipedia pretty great as when it comes to church topics.
That's awesome. 20th and 21st centuries changes in church policies about women. Other developments during the presidency of Spencer W. Kimball included having young women class advancements recognized in sacrament meeting in 1978. The first presidency of the Quorum of 12 Apostles issued a policy which approved of women praying in sacrament meeting.
Yeah. What year was that? Sorry.
1978. Wow. Women had been banned. Women had been barred praying in sacrament meeting between 1967 through 1978.
Whoa, just that 10 years.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-20th century, so many nutty things happened to the church that we're still recovering from.
But it goes later than you might think, okay?
Well, it started later than I would have thought, too.
In the April 2013 General Conference, women gave prayers for this first time.
Yeah. Wait, 23?
That's what it says.
2023?
Right,
that's not right.
2013 is what it says.
Oh, 2013. Yeah, and that sounds about right, because that's around the time of ordained women. And as we talked about in our previous show, that seems to have been a response.
Did women not really not give the prayer in
Genuinely
General Conference?
Never.
Really?
Ever. Yeah.
Hmm.
It had never happened until 2013. That's wild. But there's so many men who need an opportunity. And if we give an opportunity to a woman, Aaron, some man will not get his chance to pray in General Conference. Have you thought about how sad that is?
That is very sad. Listen, we're rabbit-holing early. Let's bring it back. Because we're I want to do more history. I want to do more history later.
Okay.
Well, I want to go back to definitions. I want to talk about priesthood and leadership because these two concepts seem to be inextricably linked in our church, but somehow they're also not. And this is what is really difficult to explain. Even out loud right here.
Yeah.
Among the two of us, right? What does it mean when I say that that leadership and priesthood are linked, but they're also not linked?
Well, I don't know what you mean by it, but I'll point out there are a lot of callings in this church which you cannot hold unless you have the priesthood. And
name
some of them
three.
Make very little sense. Sunday school second counselor.
Okay. Second counselor? What do you mean by that?
If you want to be second counselor in a Sunday school presidency and a ward, you need to have the priesthood.
What? Really?
Yeah, you have to be an elder. Can you give me any good reason for that, Aaron?
Well, I just don't even believe you at the moment.
You don't believe me?
Hold on a second.
I wish it weren't true.
In 1978, I'm quoting from Wikipedia, a policy that a woman was not allowed to be a Sunday school president was clarified to a bishop in a Boston suburb.
What year was that?
That was 1978.
78. So that policy was a little fuzzy before 78, I guess, and that's when they made it official that you can't be in a Sunday school presidency without... It says Sunday school president, but it's the same presidency because you can't have presidencies in the church that are mixed gender.
Hold on.
So you can't be a man and be second counselor in the primary presidency either because you can't have mixed gender presidencies in the church.
I think I knew this, but I did also hadn't really thought carefully about it, right? It's so obvious to me when I think about the callings that only men can have in the church, right? That I didn't really consider Sunday school president. When I was making my list just now.
Yeah.
But you're 100% right. That's only Sunday school presidents. Okay. Clerk?
Clerk, you have to be a man. Unless you live in, for instance, you're a member of a Chinese branch which has zero male members. So there are female clerks and executive secretaries in China in small, where there are no men. It's just women who are members of the church.
Bishop,
yep, you may.
State
president.
Member of the Quorum of the 70.
Yep.
Member of the Quorum of the 12.
Yeah.
Member of the General Presidency.
It's a...
Leader. Oh,
you mean the First Presidency?
First Presidency. Yeah. President of the Church.
Yes.
There's a tie between leadership and priesthood.
Yes.
But there also isn't, because there are leadership callings that women have in the church, right? It's just that they're not... It's not the same.
Well...
There are.
Yeah. Yes and no.
But listen, however much... Okay, so there's this thing in the church, uh-huh, which we love to talk about, right? Which is that there aren't... That bishops are servants.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, it's true.
Sure.
It is something that we believe. We believe that we have humble bishops, right?
Yeah.
So we don't pay them money, right? Mm-hmm. We only call them for 5 years. We release them after they're done serving,
mm-hmm,
right? And their main job is to delegate as much as possible and to make sure the young men are well taken care of.
Currently, that is the spin. Yeah, though, it's, from what I hear, like, that's been a hard transition for a lot of bishops.
Yeah, and it's, and in reality, the bishop does actually lead the ward.
Okay? Yeah.
In a very real way. They're right up there on the stand, as we talked about last, mm-hmm, week, right? They preside over every meeting, mm-hmm, right? If there's a problem, who do you go to? Right?
Bishop. The bishop. And there are certain things that they have to make the final decision on.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're over the youth, like if there's a change in ministry from the Elders' Quorum or the Relief Society, it's not official until the bishop approves it.
They really are a leader.
Yeah.
Okay? So is it because they have the priesthood that they have a leader, or does having the priesthood make them be qualified to be the leader?
This feels a little...
Look, I'm all about semantics. I want to know about yeah, why things are the way they
so
are.
So bishop is an interesting one because it's one of the most canonical positions,
okay,
with the most explanation in scripture of how it works.
All the way back to the New Testament.
Yeah.
Where we had they're described as pastors.
Probably in the most detail in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a position where, I mean, if you get called as a bishop, they give you the necessary priesthood in order to run that, to be in that position.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that this authority to act in the name of God that comes from the priesthood,
yeah,
right, is the means by which these people are ordained to these offices and given these keys.
Yeah.
And now I've exited the realm of trying to use semantics to define things. And I'm entering the realm of using Mormon religion to define things.
Okay.
A man is ordained to the office of bishop.
It is an office, yeah.
It is an office within the church.
Mm-hmm.
They are given keys,
yeah,
which allows them to exercise the authority of that office, which allows them to say, for example, during the 2020-2021 pandemic, you can bless the sacrament in your own homes,
yes,
instead of church. They were turning their keys to allow that to happen.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that is the language that we use to describe this activity.
Yeah.
This organization, this feeling of authority.
Okay. I'm with you so far.
Okay. These are definitions.
Okay. And women do not have the priesthood, is what you're saying.
So what do they have?
Well, maybe they have the priesthood.
But maybe they have the priesthood. And this is exactly why it is so hard to define leadership and priesthood.
Yeah.
Because maybe they have the priesthood.
Yeah, it's not that hard to find lists of priesthood offices. And below high priest and, you know, from the top, I suppose you'd have like the prophet, apostles, 70s. High priests, elders, and you get to the bottom of the Melchizedek priesthood. And then in the Aaronic priesthood, you have bishop, priest, teacher, deacon. And then below the Aaronic priesthood, you have member.
Yeah.
Member is often described as, I don't know if office is the right word, but part of the priesthood. Like all members have priesthood in that sense, the authority to act in God's name. And this feels a little bit like that's not in the Doctrine and Covenants. I don't think. I'd be happy to be proven wrong, but I don't think it says members have the priesthood. I think this is sort of a bit of a theological explanation of how the church actually works. And the way it actually works is everybody must have priesthood because, as you point out, you can't do anything without priesthood for the church. And so since people who don't, quote, have the priesthood, unquote, must have the priesthood.
Yes. And I want to now talk about what happens when you Google, okay, LDS women priesthood, those three words.
Okay.
All right.
Well, of course, let's keep in mind that Google knows you. And so my results or somebody else's results might be different.
Okay. From yours. It's a great point. I'm going to open an incognito window.
All right.
So women, LDS, priesthood. It looks like I'm getting the same list.
Okay. Let's hear it.
The very first link is mm-hmm. Women and the Priesthood by the Church of Jesus Christ.
Is that one of the essays?
It is exactly
okay. What are those called? The doctrinal essays?
No, actually, it's not an essay.
Oh, what is it?
Okay. I don't know. let's get the answer. Okay, Women and the Priesthood. This is a web page, but it's churchofjesuschrist.org, callings, Relief Society Organization, Work and Purpose, Women and Priesthood.
So it's a table of contents to a bunch of essays.
What it does is it says there's this opening set of quotes.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it gives scriptures that talk about priesthood, study resources that have a bunch of different gospel topics, including an essay, one of the gospel topic essays, and then a bunch of general conference talks. Let me read the quotes right at the top.
Okay.
First, President Russell M. Nelson. I entreat you to study prayerfully all the truths you can find out about priesthood power. Okay? Jean B. Bingham, Endowed with Power, Brigham Young University Women's Conference 2019, said, mm-hmm. Often we women don't realize that the power through which we accomplish, quote, much good, unquote, in our callings and in our homes is an expression of priesthood power. As a matter of fact, all the good that is done in the world is done through God's power. Knowing that women have access to that priesthood power strengthens us to be able to do what is asked in whatever responsibilities or assignments are ours. So there's this understanding, right, that women have access to God's authority when they act to do good. And of course, the most kind of famous, but not really famous, example is in the temple. And let's go ahead and talk about it.
By famous, do you mean the one that people mention in 2024? Because I think I would agree with that.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay.
I don't mean like, because it's not, because, okay, let's, the gospel topics essay that was referred to is called Joseph Smith's Teachings About Priesthood, Temple, and Women.
Oh, really?
It's awesome. But importantly, mm-hmm. It kind of defines the history of the church in such a way mm-hmm. as to explain some of the things that Joseph Smith said, right? Such as when he talked about keys and offices.
So you mean that the essay finds ways to make what Joseph Smith said fit the way we currently understand things?
You're 100% correct.
Okay.
Okay? Whether or not you would describe that as, you know, retro, like backronyming, what's a good word?
Retconning.
Retconning, that's the word I'm looking for. Or whether or not it's realistic, you know, read the essay and you can decide. But I thought it was pretty good. Okay.
Okay, not yet.
The priesthood authority exercised by Latter-day Saint women in the temple and elsewhere remains largely unrecognized by people outside the church and is sometimes misunderstood or overlooked by those within. Latter-day Saints and others often mistakenly equate priesthood with religious office and the men who hold it, which obscures the broader Latter-day Saint concept of priesthood.
Because we do have a broader concept.
Women administer ordinances in the temple.
Yes.
Okay, that's what we need to make sure is well understood mm-hmm. by those who haven't been to the temple mm-hmm. outside of our church or even within our church who are men and didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right? But it is true. So there's some priesthood authority being exercised by women in the temple without having been...
Because that's what I was pushing for, right? Early on is that priesthood is connected to ordinances in some way.
It is important not to overinterpret what happens in the temple. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
It's my favorite example.
Oh, your face is so filled with glee right now.
There's this one ordinance in the temple. It's called the washing and anointing.
Yes.
Right? And in it, there are these, you kind of move through these. How much am I allowed to talk about?
There are
veils. Yeah, there are curtains.
Yeah, sure. Okay?
There are some curtains. And at the bottom of those curtains are these little pockets. And inside those little pockets are little pieces of metal.
Uh-huh.
And I got into the temple. I was 19 years old. I was going on a mission. Uh-huh. And I looked down at that and I was like, oh, those
mean something?
Those have got to have real religious real religious significance, yeah. Man. I mean, there's got to be, I better pull one of those out and there'll be a little prayer written on them, uh-huh. or something. You know, kind of something like a, what's the thing that you're wearing? A phylactery? I mean, there's going to be something like that. They're weights.
Yeah.
They keep the curtains from moving around very
much. But, you know, in our religious tradition, all temporal things are spiritual. So.
But I think this is one where you can interpret it properly.
Yeah.
I think this is an example of women giving ordinances in the temple.
I mean, it is. There's just no other way to describe way what's happening.
It's priesthood.
There are no men in the room.
Yeah. So, priesthood is not leadership.
I feel like we went back in time. So priesthood is not leadership because it's these other things.
Yeah, it's these other things.
But does that mean it's not leadership, or is it just not only leadership?
Let's listen to this. Okay. I'm going to restate this, reading back from this essay. Saints and others often mistakenly equate priesthood with religious office.
Oh, right. I do remember you reading that now.
This is important
because...
We have
a broader definition.
I think that there are actually several conversations that we need to have when we talk about women and the priesthood in the church. One of them is religious office.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. It's why can't my mom be a bishop? Like, how many women do we know that would be great bishops?
I think at this moment, there are at least as many, if maybe a lot more.
Yeah.
Women in our ward who I can imagine
would be great bishops.
Being great bishops.
Compared to the men.
Especially if you leave out the men who have already been bishops.
Now, there's a trap here that we don't want to fall into the men are doofuses trap.
No. Like, that is
that's not what
one of the laziest arguments to, like... Put women on pedestals? No,
no. It's the classic, because there's actually this awesome bit of analysis I heard once that, you know, the old, you know, household, you know, men get freaked out by vacuum cleaners commercial that exists right there. And then there's this other thing about multitasking that women are they're really good at multitasking, right? It's all just a vague form of sexism, right? So
yeah.
See, this is the thing. This conversation is so hard because we need to keep... What we want to do in this conversation is to separate topics such as oppression from religion, right?
Uh-huh.
We want to talk about religious office and we want to talk about priesthood.
Yeah.
These are not the same thing.
No matter how much overlap they may share.
They have lots of overlap.
Yeah.
All right, and they have had traditionally too much overlap in the past.
Yeah,
religion has been used to oppress women in the past. We're gonna talk more about that here pretty soon.
Yeah,
but I think these definitions are important.
Yeah,
right, and the topics are important because I think each one of them is interesting. Right,
sure,
in relationship to men and women,
mm-hmm.
Priesthood. Religious office, oppression, ordination, right? So,
authority, opportunity.
Authority and opportunity is an interesting one too. Voices.
Mm-hmm. Value.
So, what did the church used to look like?
Yeah.
And where could it go in the future? These are kind of the questions.
Quite a number of different versions. Already.
Let's go all the way back to Paul.
All right.
Okay.
Paul.
So this is a topic that we had to cut from last episode. But boy, Paul is not well regarded.
No, there's a lot of people who don't like Paul.
Uh-huh.
And
the chapter in the book that we're going to be reading here in a minute is called An Apostolic Oinker, Paul and Women. Okay, so this book is called Paul Among the People, and it was recommended to me by our Sunday school teacher, who used it while teaching the New Testament.
Yes.
But you had already known about it.
No, that she introduced me to it also. It's just I immediately got it and read it.
Okay, you read the whole
thing. But unfortunately, I got it from the library, so I had to return it. And now months have passed, and you're now the expert.
Well, tell me about Sarah Rudin, who wrote the book, Paul Among the People, the Apostle Reinterpreted and Reimagined in His Own Time.
Yeah, I'll read the line that has been cut from the last couple times we've recorded. So she is an expert on the ancient Greeks and Romans. That is what she is an expert in. And here's how she describes her expertise. This is on page 191 if you have the paperback. My expertise, the literature of food, clothes, sex, family squabbles, petty commerce, local politics, and staying out of the rain, is a better background to Paul, I believe, though I do cite from the entire range of Greco-Roman literature. In other words, she thinks that if we don't understand food, clothes, sex, family squabbles, petty commerce, local politics, and staying out of the rain of the time, we don't understand Paul. We misunderstand him. We get a lot of stuff wrong. We miss the points he's making. We miss the references he's making. Can I give you an example from Pride and Prejudice?
Please do.
That's not nearly as far ago as Paul, right?
Uh-huh.
So my AP Lit class is reading Pride and Prejudice right now. And one of the things I like to remind them is that Pride and Prejudice takes place on an alien planet called England of like a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah.
Because it's very different from our world. And so I keep reminding them of that because it's in modern English. And although some of the grammar is a little not what we do, but they feel like people we could know, and it feels so close. And yet there's some rules about, there's things about class structure, which are just so different that, for instance, when Lady Catherine is condescending to people, nobody's offended because she is better than them. And that she's so kind as to condescend to them, it's very flattering.
Mm-hmm.
But as an American, and sure, America has certainly had its failings in this regard, but it's, deep down, Americans believe that we're equal.
Yeah.
Condescending is one of the worst things you can do. There is no nice connotation for condescension. But in Pride and Prejudice, there is, because some people are better than other people because they... So anyway, Paul is like that, only he's like 10 times further in the past.
It's so hard to understand the differences.
It's a long time ago.
And this is what Sarah Rudin's book does, is that what she does is she takes a passage of Paul... Right?
Yeah.
Quotes it to you in its entirety, not the KJV, from what I can tell.
A variety of translations, I think, sometimes her own.
And what she does, which is baller when you say it that way, and what she does is she demonstrates the culture at the time. And boy, howdy, it was not great for women back then.
No.
Okay?
Quite different from our world.
In fact, it was so bad that I'm not going to quote some of the stuff that she talks about because it's too lurid for my own tastes.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's all about oppression and slavery and stuff like that. So the chapter...
This is just the women chapter, right?
There's also just the women chapter.
Did we talk about... I feel like in an earlier episode we talked about the homosexual chapter. Did we?
Maybe. I don't think we have.
Maybe
yet.
We haven't. But it's similar, and I forget what else is in there. But a lot of the... Oh, yeah. You have it in front of you. What are the other topics?
So, no closet, no monsters. That's... Paul and homosexuality. Just following orders, Paul and the state. Nobody here but us bondsmen, Paul and slavery.
Yeah. So, I mean, slavery is such a good example, right? For us in modern America, slavery is the one thing that pretty much everybody can agree on is bad. And that's just not how the ancient world viewed it. Slavery was a necessary thing, and it wasn't going anywhere anytime soon. It was a permanent part of culture, and nobody pretended it could be otherwise. And Paul is trying to like navigate Christianity through a world where slavery is good. Women and boys are rapable if you leave them out in the open, and like just a lot of horrifying stuff.
Yeah. There's three parts of Paul's writings that she covers here. One is about silence. One is about...
Oh, yes, because this is one of the things Paul says, women better be silent in church.
Yeah.
We don't like that in 2024.
Which, of course, is contradicted by the women should pray in church, but while they're veiled, which is the second one.
Yeah, there are some contradictions in Paul.
Which he goes into.
Yeah.
But then the third one is about marriage.
You skipped the second one, I think.
Second one is veils.
Oh, okay. Veils, right. Okay.
And the
silence, veils, and marriage.
Silence, veils, and marriage.
Gotcha.
For each one of them, she puts them in historical context.
Mm-hmm.
But the veils one, to me, is the one... they're all good, but I wanted to focus on it, okay?
Yeah.
So here's the passage of Paul. 1 Corinthians 11, verses 2 through 16. I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions just as I handed them on to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the husband is the head of his wife, and God is the head of Christ. Any man who prays or prophesies with something on his head disgraces his head. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled disgraces her head. It is one and the same thing as having her head shaved. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut off her hair. But it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or to be shaved. She should wear a veil.
Such nonsense from the modern perspective.
Right? Okay. It does feel like nonsense to us.
It's just like who cares about any of this? Do what you're with whatever you want with your hair. I don't care. It's not a spiritual question at all.
But what she does, okay,
yeah.
What Sarah Rudin does is explain that hair was sexy.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was just immodest, mm-hmm. right, to not wear this veil, and that's why married women wore them, okay?
Yeah.
And prostitutes did not.
Right.
Okay?
But also, you were only allowed to wear it if you were married or wealthy or something. You read it more recently. I'll let you fill in the deep gaps.
Well, that's the point, is that it is... The historical context here is totally missing.
Yeah.
For
it's
us.
A classic marker.
When we read this, if you just sit down and you're like, okay, I'm going to do my come follow me reading.
Yeah.
Right? And you just read these verses, it's very different to us, and we just don't understand it, right? Let me go ahead and quote from Sarah Rudin. Dress was regulated in detail in Rome, talking about the veils. I think Paul's rule aimed toward an outrageous equality.
Which is not how we would read it without this context that she's about to provide.
All Christian women were to cover their heads in church, without distinction of beauty, wealth, respectability, or of privilege, so great as to allow toying with traditional appearances. The most hurtful thing about bareheaded, gorgeously coiffed wives might not have been their frivolity, but rather their thoughtless flaunting of styles that meant degradation to some of their sisters. As if a suburban matron attended an inner-city mission church in hip boots, a miniskirt, and a blonde wig. Perhaps the new decree made independent women of uncertain status or even slave women honorary wives in this setting. If the women complied, and later church tradition suggests that they did, you could have looked at a congregation and not necessarily have been able to tell who was an honored wife and mother, and who had been forced to do other stuff. This had never happened in any public gathering before. This, I believe, was Paul's ingenious combination of common sense and radical defiance for dealing with a very touchy set of issues. What polytheistic literature can best add here is some context to show just how disturbing, how distracting to men and stigmatizing to women the lack of a veil could be. Times change. In other words.
Yeah.
Right? Oppression today
mm-hmm.
in the United States, not as bad as it used to be. Right? And the religious interpretation of the expression of a veil mm-hmm. means something totally different to them as it does to us.
Yeah. So to Paul, when he says everyone wears a veil, it means everyone gets to be upper class, everyone gets to be respected, everyone gets to be loved. Because that's what the veil symbolized to them.
So that was the church back then.
Mm-hmm.
The church today is different. And that's an important thing to note as we enter the next part of our discussion.
Well, and the culture we live in is different. And we've talked about this before, but we're always influenced by the culture we're surrounded by, too. Paul was. We are.
So, returning to the priesthood.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of the expression of the priesthood that has changed over the course of the last 200 years.
Okay.
And here we go back to this distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Religious office versus the priesthood itself. Let's talk about the priesthood itself.
Okay.
The authority to act in the name of God. We've talked about how women have this authority
According to current church rhetoric.
According to certain church rhetoric in these situations. How has that changed compared to like Joseph Smith's time?
Oh, a lot.
Okay.
Is that a segue into what I brought today?
I'm teeing you up.
Thank you very much. Did you know that, you know Wilford Woodruff, fourth president of the church?
Yeah.
He and his wife Phoebe went on a mission together when they were young to Maine. And while they were there, Wilford Woodruff got very sick. So Phoebe gave him a blessing, laid her hands on his head and gave him a blessing. Actually, I don't know if it was on his head. In the early days, blessings weren't necessarily on the head. They were sometimes on the afflicted part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what she did.
What year was that again?
This was probably the Kirtland era.
Would have been in the 1800s then.
1800s, yeah. He died
mm-hmm.
in San Francisco.
Oh, that's an interesting fact.
Yeah. So just so everybody knows, I am reading an article that originally appeared in the Journal of Mormon History called Female Ritual Healing in Mormonism by Jonathan Stapley and Christine Wright.
Mm-hmm.
This came out, I'm not exactly sure how, I believe I read it over 10 years ago. I don't remember the date. It will be available. We'll find a link mm-hmm. and we will include it if you'd like to read it. It's been a while since I read it. I printed it off for myself and my printer is dying, which is why I couldn't figure out what the word how was earlier. but it's over 80 pages long, Aaron.
Okay.
I didn't remember it was so long. It's filled with fascinating stories about women giving blessings. Let me read to you the opening of the article, if I may.
First of all, do women give blessings nowadays in the church?
Oh, I don't know if I want to do that, first of all.
I just want to make the context known, because it would be weird if you weren't a member of our church.
That's true.
And didn't understand why what you're about to say is a big deal.
I think that probably over 90% of living members of the church, probably over 95%, have never seen a woman give a blessing.
Okay, go ahead.
On March 2nd, 1876, eight women from the Salt Lake 11th Ward gathered at the Wickens family home. They were fasting for Sister Wickens, who had developed a problem with her speech, and for a Sister Young, who had been a cripple for 20 years. Mary Ann Burnham Fries described what followed. They had washed Sister Young preparatory to having her anointed, which ordinance I attempted to after we had prayers. Sister Lawson, again, I'm reading off a terrible print. Sister Lawson, being mouth, made an excellent and terrible, and humble prayer. Excellent and humble prayer. Then I called Sophia, last name. Then I called Sophia to seal the anointing, which she did in a praiseworthy manner for one so young. Then I called upon Jane to anoint the head of Sister Wickens and Sister...
With oil, I presume?
I assume so, because it does say anoint.
Anoint.
And that's how we would use the word now. But again, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So it's been a long time. Then I called upon Jane to anoint the head of Sister Wickens and Sister starts with an N, Newsom maybe, to anoint, to administer to her. They both did exceedingly well. I will here mention that we all laid our hands on when each one was administered to. Then it was proposed to bless Sister Lorne Febb, she being poorly. Sister Cushing anointed and Sister Lawson blessed her. After we were through with these, Sister Aggie Tackett, who is very sick, who sent word for us to come and pray for her. We went in, and Lizzie Felt anointed, and I administered to her. Felt that they would all soon be healed. They were grateful to us, seemed to look upon us as ministering angels.
So, just to, as an aside, those kind of detailed records and stuff is so cool that
so
we
cool.
that we have that kind of language written down.
Keep your own journal.
Yeah, but what's fun is that if you went into the Berkeley Ward clerk's office
or the library
and you went into some of the old drawers, you could pull Relief Society records from the 1930s.
Yes,
that have notes.
We have really cool records.
We have really cool
from
records
from Relief Society, from the Elders Quorum, from bishopric meetings.
Yeah.
Aaron, when you hear that story,
it sounds great.
How does it sound different in any significant way from what the priesthood, quote unquote, does when they come to give a blessing?
No, it sounds nearly the same.
Yeah, that was normal. Women did this. It's interesting that before the Relief Society was even formed, which is when women started holding callings in the church, they were already regularly giving blessings. It started no later than Kirtland, and it continued on for a long time. And it made its way to Britain. So when it was common in Britain by the late 1830s, women in Britain were giving blessings, Latter-day Saint women in Britain.
So this is described, by the way, in the Gospel Topics essay.
Oh, is it? What do they have to say about it?
So two paragraphs, which I'll go ahead and read. During the 19th century, women frequently blessed the sick by the power of faith, and many women received priesthood blessings promising that they would have the gift of healing. Quote, I have seen many demonstrations of the power and blessing of God through the administration of the sisters, testified Elizabeth Ann Smith Whitney, who was, by her own account, blessed by Joseph Smith to exercise this gift.
Many women's patriarchal blessings gave them, or identified them as having the gift of healing.
In reference to these healing blessings, Relief Society General President Eliza R. Snow explained in 1883, quote, women can administer in the name of Jesus, but not by the virtue of the priesthood, end quote. Okay, next paragraph. Women's participation in healing blessings gradually declined in the early 20th century, as church leaders taught that it was preferable to follow the New Testament directive to call for the elders.
I'm going to push back against that one a little bit.
Well, hold on a second. Okay, let me finish ahead. The paragraph. By 1926, Church President Heber J. Grant affirmed that the church presidency, that the first presidency, do not encourage calling in the sisters to administer to the sick, as the scriptures tell us to call in the elders, who hold the priesthood of God and have the power and authority to administer to the sick in the name of Jesus Christ, unquote. That quote started at do not encourage. Currently, the church's handbook number 2, Administering the Church, directs that only Melchizedek priesthood holders may administer to the sick or afflicted.
Yeah.
Doesn't say why this change occurred. It just noted that there was this cult, that there was this a few statements for some from some early leaders.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your counter argument?
Okay, so keep in mind that I am summarizing an article that's over 80 pages long, so a lot of the facts and nuance are going to get left out, but I will say a couple things. So yes, they were gradually reclining, and why?
They were gradually reclining is what you said.
Did I say reclining?
You did. Oh,
they were gradually declining, and why? Well, one reason that I think we can't ignore, and is related to what we talked about before, is just sort of Victorian and Edwardian mores, like women shouldn't do things. So like a lot of weird things that got into church culture around the same time, I think it just comes from the outside culture in part. Second, it seems that it was women who took the lead on not giving blessings and not men. Women were constantly writing the Relief Society General Presidency and the male leaders of the church in Salt Lake also, asking if it was okay if they gave blessings. And it became such a common question, and the brethren were so irritated having to answer so much that they just made up a common response that was printed off, and they could just send back and say, yes, you can give blessings. Of course you can give blessings. Women have always given blessings. My mom gave blessings. Like, you can give blessings. And that sort of continued. But here's the thing, Aaron. If you continue to ask permission and you need permission every time to do something, eventually someone's going to say no. And then the permission's gone and you don't get to ask next time because now it's over. And that's essentially what happened. Like, the women kept asking so many times that eventually somebody thought better of it and they started saying no.
Well, there's some opinion there, which is I agree
with.
But I want to know the reference for the form letter.
Oh, okay. I have 84 pages, mm-hmm. poorly printed. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to edit something out here while I look for it.
Is it in this article?
It is in this article, yes. Well, while you're waiting for me to find it, check this out.
The Relief Society. This is, what you've shown me here is, blessing the sick, soothe the sad, succor the distressed, visit the widow and fatherless. This is detail from a Relief Society banner from 1903. That's cool.
It is cool.
It's a pretty kind of old-timey stylized yeah. font.
It's pretty cool. Click includes. On the link and you can see it for yourself. Scroll down. It's on page 59. This is not what you asked for.
Okay.
But this is a fun story.
Okay.
In 1914, the Relief Society General Board invited President of the Church, Joseph F. Smith, to speak at its October General Conference. In delivering his discourse, Smith recounted a story in which he had told a good many times. He described visiting a remote region of the church where malaria was prevalent. Accompanied by a local church leader, President Smith called on them, the sick, visited them, and administered to them. In one home, in particular, the mother lay prostrate upon her bed, and her husband was distracted for fear she was going to pass away, little children helpless. Smith then described a woman who came to the home with a basket of food. She washed the children and prepared a meal for them. It's worth mentioning that often in the past, washing someone before anointing and blessing them was common. Then she turned and administered to the sick mother, and she remained there during at least the fore part of the night. I asked, how is this done? Well, she said, our Relief Society is doing it. The Society is providing those things. I am only acting here for the Relief Society. But for this evening until midnight. And I said, is this being done through the settlement? Is this being done throughout the settlement by the Relief Society? She said, yes. And I added, and none are neglected? No, not one. All are provided for. Yes, all are provided to the best of our ability. And I said in my heart, God bless the Relief Society. I felt that the Lord would bless them because they were doing their work for the sick and the afflicted. The same day, Joseph F. Smith recounted this story to the Relief Society General Conference. He and his counselors wrote a circular letter to all stake presidents and bishops. They commented that the First Presidency frequently received questions in regard to washing and anointing our sisters preparatory to their confinement. Confinement meaning, you know, pregnancy and giving birth and so forth. Even though the Relief Society previously sent circulars to answer such questions, there exists some uncertainty as to the proper persons to engage in this administration, with the result that the First Presidency have therefore considered it necessary to answer some of these questions and give such explanations as will place this matter in the right light. We quote some of these questions and give our answers. The answers reaffirm the consistent policies that any woman full of faith can participate in the rituals and that the Relief Society need not direct all administrations. The First Presidency affirmed that women have, quote, have the same right to administer to sick children and adults and may anoint and lay hands upon them in faith, unquote. The letter also carefully outlined the importance of reserving sealings to the priesthood and specified that being endowed was not prerequisite to ritual healing.
Okay, so this is kind of exactly what I was asking for, actually. So,
yeah, that was there.
That was there.
I knew it was Joseph F. Smith, so I was just hoping that we would get there, and we did. So,
so Joseph F. Smith visited these islands? Is that what?
It was just some remote area of the church. Remote area. He was not clear about where.
Okay, some people were sick. The women were administering to them, including washing and anointing.
Yeah.
And they said, is this fine? And he said, yes, right?
Of course, yeah.
And then they did this other thing.
Yeah.
Right? That is a different narrative that is kind of presented here in this article.
Yeah.
This article really skips. It wasn't like the narrative kind of in this article, this Gospel Topic essay, kind of reads like women were doing this.
Yeah.
And then the men stopped it.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's more like women were doing this and men changed their minds.
Yeah, kind of. I think there's a lot of things going on here. I don't want to oversimplify the narrative. Like, for instance, I'm really tempted to say something like women were partaking of the fruit and then the world was saying, hey, women can't do stuff like this from the great and spacious building. They were embarrassed and they fell away. Because like that feels like a fair metaphor to me.
Yeah.
But I think it's also very unfair. I also think that...
Just in defense of this article.
Yes.
This is a complicated subject.
It's a complicated subject.
They're doing the best they can.
They're trying to turn into something you can read in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I haven't spoken about this article with very many women who've read it. But the one thing that the women I've spoken to who have read this article feel is the greatest loss, and it was sort of touched on in what I just read, but it goes into more detail. Like, it was really common for women in their pregnancy to be blessed by other women in the Relief Society. And that was a really important ritual. It was part of being a pregnant Mormon woman, was having the other women come to you and wash you and anoint you and bless you in your confinement. And the women I've spoken to just find that really beautiful and wish that was still part of our tradition.
Do you think that it was stopped, or did they just stop? See the difference in what I said?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a parallel story real quick. Another thing that the church used to do was baptize for healings. Like, you could get baptized for a healing.
What are you talking about?
This is a real thing, Aaron. And it was something... In fact, I have here another picture from the article. You want to check that out? Don't try to read the temple recommend. Just read the caption.
The temple recommend... These are two temple recommends, right?
I think they might be front and back.
Front and back. Could be front and back.
Recommends of Ethel Naylor for the Logan Temple. The 1918 recommend allows her to be baptized for her health. And the 1920 recommend is for... anointing for her health and endowments for the dead.
So it is two recommends.
Yeah.
All right.
Photocopy of the original in possession of Ben and Whitney Mortensen, used by permission.
All right. So we don't baptize for healings anymore. Have you? I take it from your initial reaction. I've
literally never heard of this.
Yes. Okay. We don't do that anymore. So here's another thing. I already knocked like Victorian culture, but here's another thing that I think has happened is that as time has gone on and we've come to understand things like germ theory, as one example, and the sciences more generally, and we understand how the human body works more. Baptisms for healing, once you learn about germ theory, it doesn't sound like a particularly good idea to have all the sick people get in the same water.
You mean in the same petri dish?
Yeah. So that fell away largely, I think, because of science, honestly. I mean, on this show, we don't like pitting science and religion against each other.
Oh, sure we do.
But I think that that's what happened here. And I suspect that something similar happened with blessings. Like, women don't need a blessing to get through their pregnancy safely. Yeah. They need a good someone with medical experience. I had an experience. I'm a little embarrassed about this, and I didn't even realize it until it was too late. But I came down with COVID a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I tested and found out I was positive as my parents were driving up to see us for the weekend. Mm-hmm. So my parents basically got there, turned around, and went back home. I'm sorry, mom.
Yeah.
12 hours in the car
for
like maybe an hour at our house. Like,
rough beats.
Yeah, it was bad. But before they left, my dad said, "Hey, would you like a blessing?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'd totally like a blessing." It didn't occur to me to ask for one.
Yeah.
But I was grateful he asked. And then after I got sick, everybody in my family got sick. And I can blame this partially on the fact that I also had COVID and was just lying in bed mostly.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I didn't think to offer my family blessings. And nobody asked me for one.
Yeah.
I think that I've had experiences where I definitely believe that blessings and prayer can like be beneficial to health. I absolutely believe that. I have experiences. But I am a modern, science-centered human from the 2020s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not the first thing I think about. The first thing I think about is getting proper rest and getting sufficient hydration and, maybe... If it's early enough in the illness to get some antivirals.
And quarantine.
And quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, I'm focused on things, and I don't think that's wrong.
Like, we've
greater light of knowledge, right?
We've had COVID in our house.
Yeah.
That passed through the house and didn't infect some of our family members.
Oh, good for you guys.
Because of quarantine.
Properly quarantining. Yeah. So, I don't want to, like, oversimplify or overcomplicate this, but I think there's just so many moving parts here. And I think it's a tragedy that we've lost the tradition of women giving blessings, especially to pregnant women, because it seems like that's a real gap. It
seems nice.
Yeah.
I like it.
And then I've mentioned this on the show before, too, but in the 80s, my parents came home from the adult session of state conference once, instructed by the state presidency that mothers should be standing in on blessings fathers give.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a long history of that, and there were definitely old timers in this small Idaho town who remembered their mothers standing in and women giving blessings. And even though it was largely stamped out by the Heber G. Grant era, as you said, like, it didn't disappear. And in places where it's really concentrated with Mormons, the oral and those sorts of traditions just lasted longer. But it never became when church ritual became entirely written. Like, I have in my wallet a little trifold paper that tells me how to do every single ordinance that I am authorized to do.
Yeah.
And I followed the instructions. And there was a time where that's not how you did it. You just learn from watching other people. There's some things where you have to follow a certain format, like the sacrament, for instance. But something like a father's blessing, that you just did what you were taught to do and what you saw others doing, and it wasn't codified like it is today. And part of the codification cut women out.
So, priesthood, religious office. kind of different topics. Mm-hmm. We've really been focusing on priesthood itself.
Can I tell another story real quick?
Yes.
Is this going to mess you up?
It will mess me up, but that's okay.
So I wasn't prepared to, I don't have the link, we'll have to look for it, but Fiona Givens gave a talk a while ago, I'm not sure how many years ago, and in it, she'd been doing research on the Early Relief Society, and I'm going to summarize what she said, and it's not going to be exactly accurate, but we'll find the link and include it. But when Joseph Smith officially started the Relief Society Party, what he did was he gave women the priesthood, and he said, you guys can decide how the priesthood works.
Okay, this is actually in the article.
Okay, let's hear what the article says.
Okay, and it's not quite
how I remember Fiona Givens described it.
Here's what the Gospel Topics thing says. The restoration of the priesthood authority through Prophet Joseph Smith is a fundamental doctrine of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Early in his ministry, Joseph Smith received priesthood authority from heavenly messengers. With that authority, he organized the church, conferred priesthood upon other men, and ordained them to offices in the priesthood. By the same authority, Joseph Smith organized the Relief Society as part of the structure of the church, which formally defined and authorized in major aspects of women's ministry. All this was done to prepare the saints to participate in the ordinances of the temple. Right? Okay. But, skipping forward.
Yeah.
Joseph Smith taught that Christ's priesthood was lost after the deaths of the ancient apostles, and had been newly restored through angelic ministration. Even so, many Latter-day Saints initially understood the concept of priesthood largely in terms common for the day. In 1830s, America, the word priesthood was defined as the office or character of a priest, and the order of men set apart for sacred offices, identifying priesthood with religious office and the men who held it. Early Latter-day Saints likewise thought of priesthood primarily in terms of ordination to ecclesiastical office and authority to preach and perform religious rites. Okay?
Yeah.
So, unlike in many other churches, Latter-day Saints extended priesthood ordination broadly to laymen as directed by Revelation. Gave
layman.
The keys.
L-A-Y-M-E-N.
Yes, right.
It's like layman. Isn't he dead by now?
Right?
Yes.
So, okay, so now this goes to the Relief Society, okay? Wanting to provide charitable support to men working to build the temple, a group of Latter-day Saints, women, planned to form a benevolent society, mirroring a popular practice of the time. When they presented their plan to Joseph Smith, he felt inspired to move beyond such precedents, right?
Yeah.
That he had something better. That was what Sarah Granger said, a founding member. He would organize the women in the order of the priesthood after the pattern of the church.
Yes.
Okay? Which is kind of what you said.
I would kind of love it if this were canonized.
Yeah. But, okay, that's what this article says.
Is that where it stops?
Is that it's definitional.
Mm-hmm. So.
Hold on.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. These statements indicate that Joseph Smith delegated priesthood authority to women in Relief Society. Joseph Smith's language can be more fully understood in historical contexts. During the 19th century, Latter-day Saints used the term keys to refer at various times to authority, knowledge, or temple ordinances. Likewise, members of the church sometimes used the term ordain in a broad sense, oftentimes interchangeably with set apart and not always referring to priesthood office. On these points, Joseph Smith's actions illuminate the meaning of his words. Neither Joseph Smith, nor any person acting on his behalf, nor any of his successors, conferred the Aaronic or Melchizedek priesthood on women, or ordained women to priesthood office. In later years, words like ordination and keys were more precisely defined. So this article argues that the language that you're using, okay, and that Joseph Smith used, was more precisely, that it mirrored kind of the understanding of the day and was more precisely refined to kind of exclude the meaning that you want to ascribe to it, which is that women were given priesthood authority in the same way that you would think of it nowadays, ordained to the priesthood.
Yeah. So 2 points.
Okay.
First of all,
that's what the article
says. I'm not in the business of saying it's wrong.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give an argument against it.
Okay, great.
First, it's interesting to say that we now use the words more precisely, because essentially what you're saying is Joseph Smith didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. Yeah. Which I don't love. I mean, I wish I could remember where, but I just recently read something. It was in the scriptures, and it must have been in the DNC. Yeah, it was in, I don't remember what section it was, but I was reading the DNC while I was in the temple last week, and while I was waiting for an endowment session to start, and it said that someone was being ordained. I want to say it was a woman being ordained, and the footnote said, or set apart.
Uh-huh.
But like...
Yeah. Okay, but we need to, again, right? define our terms. What does it mean when we use the phrase set apart in our church nowadays?
Set apart means you're put into a specific role, a calling.
Yeah.
And it could be something like bishop.
Men and women are set apart.
Yeah, but it could also be something like primary chorister. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying one involves a priesthood, the ordination of priesthood office, and the other one doesn't, but they're both settings apart in a sense.
Yeah.
Because you're being put into a calling.
Okay.
And whereas ordination means you're like getting some new kind of priesthood you didn't have before. That's how we use the terms now. And it is helpful to have very specific terms. And perhaps Joseph Smith was just sloppy and hadn't really thought it through. Because I think there are times we can say that's true about Joseph Smith. But I think just to say he was wrong and he just wasn't using the words right, I think you need a little bit more evidence than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the article, maybe they have it, but it's not there. The second thing I want to say is back to Fiona Givens and uh-huh. her argument is the way she understood the notes and in the speech she gave is that Joseph Smith gave the women the priesthood after the order of the church, like you quoted, and then sort of left it up to the women what that would look like. And if they wanted to, I'm being a bit flippant here and going on memory, so I'm not quoting anyone here. And if they wanted to, they could have fun little offices like deacon, teacher, and priest, just like the men, right? Because it's fun to have offices. And the women decided, like, no, we don't want to do that. We'll just all be equal. We all have the priesthood. That's good enough. And the women decided not to institute a structure more like how the men had it.
Okay, so I want to, what you just all said was interesting, but I want to see the article.
Yeah, here. I will have to find it, and okay. we'll include it in the show notes. And I mean, if you want me to start searching, I can.
No. Quick, but... What we'll do is we'll include it, and if you're wrong about what Fiona okay. said,
well,
I'll say that in the show notes.
Okay, sounds good. Anyway, but so that's interesting. In some ways, like, that feels very Zion-y to have all the women equal in the priesthood. There are no, like, nobody's above anybody else. Like, teachers aren't higher than deacons, for instance. But also, I think it could have been an error, because when something isn't well defined, it's easy to say it doesn't exist.
Yeah, it is true. Laurels and Maya maids and beehives, right? When did that come around?
They were called something different. That's a good question.
Those are groupings within the young women's group,
right? Just like deacons, teachers, priests are now young men callings, although that wasn't true like in the distant past.
Yeah, it's sort of a doctrine and covenants thing.
Yeah, but I don't know exactly when those showed up. I want to say the 80s, but maybe the 70s.
It's okay.
Yeah, they went through various name changes before that. By the way, did you know that the Relief Society, when it was founded, was not for all the women of the church?
Are you referring to black people?
No, I mean, like, you had to be invited, you had to pay dues. It wasn't for all women in the church until the Correlation era, like the 1970s.
Oh, interesting.
Before that, like, it still was kind of like a social club, and not all women of the church were part of it.
So what do you mean that you had to... Okay, so you had to pay dues to be in the Relief Society.
Yeah.
Oh, this is about this time when the Relief Society changed from being a financially independent organization...
Yes.
...to being folded into the office of the first president.
That's right. And the Relief Society magazine was closed,
mm-hmm.
As all the magazines were collapsed into one thing.
Okay.
So this is part of Correlation, which one of the side effects of Correlation, and we've talked about this before, there are good aspects of Correlation, but not all the aspects of it were good. And one of them is just sort of the disempowering of women.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of that.
Okay. Let's revisit some of our themes today.
Okay.
We're talking about priesthood and religious office.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about changes in the past compared to now, and we want to talk about the future, right? And we're trying to define religious terms that are hard to define.
Yeah.
We're trying to point out the differences between the way our church talks about these things and where people that maybe are not members or are less familiar talk about these things as well, right?
Yeah.
And I remain in kind of a position where I'm avoiding value statements here, but I know we've made a bunch of them today. And
yeah,
that's mainly the historicist in me.
Like, I want question whether we agree with ourselves.
Yeah, and okay, it's an interesting way to put it. I'm also just trying to explore the topic, right? And I want to go deeper on it. And because I want to go deeper on it, I have to say I think we're not done.
Okay.
So we're at about over an hour at this point. And I haven't yet talked about the ERA, which I want to talk about.
Oh, okay. That's okay. I wasn't expecting that to come up.
I haven't talked about alternate ways that one could reorganize the church,
mm-hmm.
right? To, you know, create new priesthoods, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't talked about value, about, we haven't really talked about how the fact that only men hold the priesthood, how that feels for women.
Right? Yeah.
Look, let's just restate the obvious, right? We're still here. You know, we're in the church and we're believers. You know, our wives are. I think that some of the women that we know are not as happy about these topics.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say about the feeling, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We don't know why the Lord organized the church this way. We don't know if the church will be the same in the future as it is now. We don't know if it will change. Will women ever be called? Will we ever have a female president of the church?
Well, that brings us back to Paul, potentially.
Right?
Not for president of the church, but in terms of...
changes.
Changes in, like, women holding positions of authority.
Right? Or is there something... and I hate this argument, but I'm going to... but in the interest of completion,
okay.
I'm going to state it, okay? Men and women are different.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
You want to... I just learned something about this. You want to hear it?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I was reading an article in The Atlantic. We can link to it. but women on average, not talking about individuals.
There's nobody checking on us, you know?
I know.
We don't have to say, we're going to link to it.
Yeah, well, man, we are peer-reviewed. This is a peer-reviewed podcast. That's not true.
All right.
Anyway, so I'm talking about generalities here, not individuals.
Yeah.
But generally, women's minds are sharpest at 80 degrees.
Uh-huh.
And men's minds are sharpest at 74 degrees.
Is that real or are you making
that's
that up?
That's real.
Okay.
Yeah. That is real. Obviously, I'm not talking about individuals. I think I run a little warmer than my wife, for instance.
So office buildings are sexist.
Yeah. Which women have been saying for a long time.
Which they have.
But now we have science to back it up.
Yeah. But is there this is what I'm trying to say, which I hate this argument.
Don't worry, I'll interrupt you again.
Okay. But are women... like, why don't men hold the priesthood and there's this argument.
That I know where you're going.
But it's so sexist, right?
Yeah.
Because it is, there's something different about men and women in the eternities, right? Relating to motherhood.
That's not where I thought you were going.
Motherhood and fatherhood, right?
Yeah.
And I hate this argument. I really do. And the reason I hate it is so many reasons.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, it's a really lazy argument.
It's a really lazy argument.
Because it just
argument.
Says, well.
It just is this way this is, and we're not going to, we don't ever care if it changes.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't take into account how religion has led to oppression. It doesn't take into account trans people.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't take into account Heavenly Mother and what we know about her.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't take into account feeling. And feeling is so important. You know, my favorite argument against are we living in a simulation is that it doesn't feel like we are. Okay? And I know that that's an intrinsic contradiction, but it's the only one I have. So when I look at the fact that my mom can't be a bishop, right? Mm-hmm. That's something, I feel something about that, right? Yeah. When I hear about how women feel in the church not being able to hold the priesthood, they don't talk about it in art where we can hear, okay, within the chapels of the church. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
But they are talking about it, all right? And they do feel that way, and some of them. Right?
Well, and even if they don't, they still feel it.
I really want to be careful to make it sound... I don't want to make it sound like I'm talking on behalf of some people that I'm not, right?
Yeah.
All I'm talking about is my observations. And I can feel the way they're feeling, right? Which is a bit oppressed.
Yeah. Fair, yeah.
Am I wrong?
No. No, you're not wrong. I'm going to speak really obliquely for a second. We had one comment from a sister we know about our last episode about something we didn't talk about.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about it intentionally because the women it most directly affected didn't want us to.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to continue with super obliqueness. But one of those women has, even though I feel like I'm pretty up on this sort of stuff, like she's really good at not letting us fall into old assumptions. She's really good at saying what she is feeling that it's really easy for men to forget about because we don't have to think about it. And I appreciate that a lot because even people so enlightened, Aaron, as yourself and myself, when you're in the advantage class, you just don't have to understand how the disadvantage class works.
Yeah.
Like, and no matter how hard you try, you will never be able to think about it as clearly as they do.
You read the scripture, Adam fell that men might be, and men are that they might have joy, and you love it your entire life.
Yeah.
I'm speaking from example because I just taught this lesson. 2 Nephi chapter 10, chapter 2, one of my favorite scriptures in the entire Book of Mormon. For some reason, I got to teach 2 days on it to the seminary class.
You should ask him to see his tattoo sometime.
Whose tattoo?
Yours.
Mine?
I'm just joking.
I don't have it. What are you talking about?
Your Adam Fell tattoo.
My Adam Fell tattoo.
This is audio. You can claim anything you like. Go ahead. Anyway, sorry for interrupting you.
I'm not entirely sure what just happened, but I want to know that I'm behind you 100%.
Okay.
In all your endeavors.
Thank you.
Adam fell that men might be and men are that might have joy is one of my absolute favorite scriptures.
Yeah.
I taught it to my kids when we would read this Book of Mormon together when we were younger. And I was put into bed and I was tired and I didn't want to read it, right? I would recite that verse from memory. My kids knew that verse, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the most, the old seminary video that says, you know, that has the guy who was like a religious guy in Italy.
Oh, I love that one.
Who was it's part of Francesco or something.
Yeah, Francesco.
Yeah, Di Francesca or something.
Di Francesca? I forget. Anyway, I love that one.
And he says, you know, why are we...
A rare possession. It's on YouTube.
Someone asks him, like, why are we even here? And he says, men are that they might have joy. You know, Adam fell that men might be.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, whoa, that is so cool because it is so cool.
Yeah.
Right? We believe that the fall was on purpose.
Yeah.
We believe we're here because we can have joy.
Amen.
Okay? And yet, it is a biased verse.
Eve is left out of that verse.
Eve is left out of that verse because it wasn't Adam that fell. It was Adam and Eve that fell.
Well, it was even Adam, really.
It was even Adam that fell. And the proper way to read that verse is even Adam fell that men might... That men... Gee, I just screwed it up right there.
It's challenging.
Even Adam fell that...
We.
Okay, no.
Oh, no.
Even Adam fell that people might be, and people are that they might have joy, right? Yeah. That's a modern reading of that scripture, and I heard someone at church recently read it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very powerful to me, and so I tried to incorporate that into my seminary lesson and for it to be inclusive. 100 years ago, it wouldn't have mattered. People...
Well, it did matter.
No. Okay, but it wouldn't have... People didn't bump against it.
Yeah, they didn't... Yeah.
Right? It wouldn't have triggered...
The number of people who thought about it was presumably much smaller.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe they did, but...
It's hard to say. We weren't there.
We weren't there. But my point is that we've got to start looking for these opportunities.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we should do another show on this topic, and let's just continue this conversation where we ended off.
So I just started reading the Brief Theological Introduction series of books published by the Neil Maxwell Institute on the Book of Mormon. And I'm almost done with 1 Nephi. The only chapter I have left is Where Are the Women in 1 Nephi? And I have to say the book has been brilliant so far. I almost brought it up a couple times in this conversation. It was a little tangential, so I left it out. But I think that next chapter may be relevant to our...
So the chapter is called again?
I don't remember what it's called, but...
Where Are the Women in 1 Nephi?
But basically, the book is all... It's one book on 1 Nephi.
Yeah.
The first half of the book was about the structure of 1 Nephi. He pointed out a lot of stuff I hadn't really thought about before in terms of how the book is structured and how that points us to think about certain things. And then the second half is sort of the big three questions that people have, like, what's the deal with killing Laban?
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with Laman and Lemuel? And then where are the women? And so I have just Where the Women left.
Well, that sounds awesome.
They're really good books. I mean, I based that on the first one.
So we're clearly not done.
Yeah,
but that's okay.
We'll do it again.
And
I didn't get to share my St. Augustine story.
Okay, I'll hold it.
Okay, yeah.
We're a proud member of the Dialogue Podcasting Network.
Yeah, they have a new podcast.
Okay.
Blair Hodges, an acquaintance of mine, has started a new one called Family Proclamations.
Okay.
Might want to check it out.
Okay, I like the title of that one. We thank Daniel Foster Smith for our music, and we especially thank our Discordians. We got way more feedback than we've ever had gotten on Discord from our last episode, and we really enjoyed it. And
I think it's fair to say Discord is fairly male-centric.
It probably is, and yeah, I wish
it was. We would love to have more people join us.
Yeah, please do. And is that it? Are we done?
No, I mean, but we'll have to come back.
I really feel like I haven't talked about a tenth of what I want to talk about.
Same face and hat time, same face and hat channel.
Okay. More women, more conversation, less oppression. Let's go.
Two guys talking.
Bye, Eric.
See ya.